So my guest today is Rohit Krishnan, CPO at Bodo AI, author of Building God, Demystifying AI for Decision Makers. Rohit was previously McKinsey's European lead for growth technology and a co-founder at Fab AI. Rohit's, I think, for my money, one of the most interesting AI researchers out there, not so much on the building of the models themselves, but rather in their practical applications of modern AI agents, looking at how they integrate with real-world systems, which is what we'd be discussing today. Rohit publishes his findings regularly via his Strange Loop Cannon newsletter. Rohit, thanks so much for chatting with me.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great. So I'd like to start by just giving people a bit of a sense of what's possible out there for even a relatively non-technical person in terms of making use of AI agents as they exist today. Some of your research recently has been absolutely fascinating to read. And I wonder if you could just walk us through briefly. There was a case of looking into some novel science, a paleontology question that your son asked you about. Can you just walk us through that quickly?
Sure, very happy to. I'm always happy when a conversation starts with dinosaurs, because I think that is underrated and should be done more often. One of the beneficial things about AI today, and this wasn't true 6 months ago, this much less like, you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, is that you effectively have an analyst with you for whatever question that you want to ask it, as long as you're able to sit with it and work with it. The way I think about it, and I had this conversation recently, is imagine everybody had a research assistant that you could put any question to. And they're, you know, very smart, indefatigable, works really hard. You obviously have to like guide them quite a bit because they're not, you know, perfect, but they're really good at what they do. So in any scenario where you're able to gather enough data, you're able to kind of wring insights from it in a way that before would have required you to hold like a whole team of people working on it for several weeks or months. So the specific thing that you talked about is my son had this question about Spinosaurus. It's one of his favorite dinosaurs. It's my younger son. And he had questions about functional similarity, like Spinosaurus has a spine, it looks like a big sail. Sailfish has the same thing. Some of the modern animals have it, as well as sort of before Dimetrodon had it, for example. So why does this happen? Or like, you know, what does this mean that these animals are related to each other, was one of the questions that he had. Now, we know that the answer is no. But like, I had this thought process that if this question is, like, if you take this question seriously, like if you were, you know, doing graduate study somewhere, you would take this question seriously and go like, okay, there are some hypotheses that you can come up with that if you get enough data, you can prove or disprove some of these hypotheses. So you don't need to like guess at the answer. So it's like, okay, let's take a look at what is the art of the possible here. So I looked around and I was like, I discovered a couple of databases. Effectively, the idea here is that like once you are able to identify a large enough subset of history, paleontology, like with from the fossil records, etc., you should be able to figure out a couple of things that are super interesting here. So an example here might be that like at times when the environment changes quite a lot, the animals start becoming more or less similar. Now, I thought they would become sort of more similar. Some of it is because like I have this like long-standing hypothesis that a large amount of the evolutionary push that has happened in the world is because of tectonic plates shifting. And actually, you know, you do a little bit of etch-a-sketch in the world and that allows new things to actually emerge. So plausible that it is one of the things that I wanted to check. The other thing that I wanted to check here was like, in would different parts of the clades become more interchangeable when climes are extremely volatile? Because the hypothesis being that like if clades are very volatile, then animals would get pushed down a sort of narrower evolutionary path that they would start doing roughly the
certain
same stuff
robust in different places. Adaptations.
Precisely. Precisely.
Universal.
And so the original supposition, of course, was that like the tectonic plates will cause some kind of convergence, that like if large tectonic plate shifts happen, that actually has a direct impact on the types of evolutionary adaptations that ends up happening, for example. But, you know, there's a set of these ones that you can come up with, right? Like you might have different ideas that like the volatility might increase or decrease. This might change from period to period. Each period has a certain number of clades and stuff that kind of come out of it over a certain period of time. You can slice it in different time chunks and you can do the analysis to try and figure out like how do ecosystems actually converge or diverge in these time periods to figure out whether it makes sense or not. Like if you think about what I just said, that's like a fairly hefty amount of work. And like, you wouldn't necessarily do that in an afternoon just sitting around because like, it's a huge amount of work. And like, you might have had these ideas and everybody has hypotheses and theories, right? From like the crackpots on the street to like CEOs to every normal person, we all have theories about how the world works. And we talk about these theories to each other all the time. Sometimes it's like normal theories, sometimes it's crazy theories, but like we all hold them, except that none of us are able to prove or disprove most of them. And we just kind of go through life because it sort of doesn't matter if they're right or wrong. Like if all my theories about, you know, paleontology are completely false, it does not matter that much to my daily life if I do not go into that field and try to sort of poke about it or something. However, now, like I discovered there were these databases of, you know, climate change historically, as well as fossil records historically that people have annotated. And once you have data, then you're able to actually use these analysts that we have in our hands, and I used Codex primarily, to effectively analyze them and slice them in any way that you want in order to get the answer that you need. And you can do that comfortably, happily, reliably, and it will present the information back to you in any format that you desire or choose. So like, you know, you prefer getting some things as graphs versus tables, some things as tables versus graphs. Sometimes it's a write-up that you want. Sometimes it's an essay. Sometimes, you know, it's like three bullet points. Sometimes it's just like, tell me whether you did it, yes or no. Any one of these things are possible and you kind of get the information back after going through half an hour, 3 hours of analysis on some complex question that you've set it. You can even ask it, hey, I have these like seven different things that I want you to do. Can you do like a sweep across all of them overnight and just tell me what you found in the morning? These are things that would have required a lab or at least, you know, several graduate students that you wanted to throw at them for them to get the answer back to you over a period of time.
Not to mention some significant skills and SQL and so on.
But correct.
What you're just describing there, you've for the sake of the audience, you've talked about please go away. That would could be literally the what you're asking the model, right? You could,
correct,
just in plain English, I would like to know such and such. Could you please go away and bring these two data sets together and see if that's true? Something of that nature.
Think about it this way. If you say that you have a hypothesis, the hypothesis is that if the landscape is less stable, if the climate is less stable, then we will see more and more ecosystems actually look more and more similar. If that's your hypothesis that you start with, this is just an idea in your head. Then you kind of go like, I need to get information about all of the animals and fossils, records, etc. that exist. That's one part of the data. I need to get all of the information about the climate variations and all of the information about that tectonic plates, etc. That is another part of the data. Then you effectively say like, I need to combine these two things together in some format, not to mention it, like this is just with the simple example of two. There's more of course. You need to combine them, create some kind of a canonical stream of information, then against that information, you need to run your hypotheses and tests. Like, for example, I learned that like partly due to paucity in terms of annotations, you cannot use the paleobiology part of the database, paleobiology database very easily for a lot of land-based fossil records because we just don't have enough annotations. There's a data quality issue. I mean, at the underlying every major analysis is a data quality issue. So you have to then look at that and then go like, okay, so we want to just do it on marine convergence. And guess what? I want to slice it by like Paleozoic and Mesozoic and Cenozoic. And then I want to slice it by location. All of these are theoretically doable. But if you have to do it without the help of this analyst, either you are writing the SQL queries yourself or the Python yourself, testing the answer, checking it, making sure it all works and doing it repeatedly over and over again. And I mean the royal sort of you in the sense that it's not just you or your entire team. Like this is what you would do before, right? You would give somebody a task and you would say like, go figure this out or help figure it out, understand if this works or come back. And they might come back with, it's almost never that they come back with yes or no. They come back with some findings and then you interrogate those findings and say, does that make sense? Maybe not. Some parts of it make sense, so we need to manipulate our question again. And like over a period of like weeks or months, you sort of narrow down on the specific question that you're asking until eventually the questions and the answers that you're finding converge to something that you think is interesting enough and close enough to your original supposition that it becomes like a finding that you can deal with. Like
Whereas now it's
it's magical.
a bit of spare time for you after the kids are in bed.
Yes,
Something
primarily.
like this, right?
I mean, it's crazy because like things of yesterday or day before, whenever they launched the ability for you to more easily do it on the mobile, like you can just kind of ask, you can continue asking these questions and responding the same way you would do to like an email when you're on the go. This was primarily, yes, after the kids were in bed and you kind of just hacking around. But like it's trivial to have something run a large number of things on the side when you're trying to do other things. It's like even if I have something else going on, if I'm writing or if I'm reading or if I'm doing something else, I can just have an analyst kind of go off and yes, it'll interrupt me every half an hour to tell me something. I'll have to think about it for a little bit, kind of give it some feedback and loop it over again. And if you're not in like a time crunch, like you have to get it done in the next 2 hours or whatever, you can kind of let it, you can play with it. You can go in crazy directions and figure out various things that like you might never have thought of or like you might not have been interested to come back. Like I didn't think, I never had this hypothesis that if the climate, if the before the Cambrian explosion kind of like blew out all of life, sort of so to speak, it itself like a stylized fact, not like a real fact, but the Paleozoic seas were pretty simple, and at the same time the Cenozoic seas have a floor, so the marine system is fairly entrenched in the sense that it's really hard to shake things loose once it gets entrenched into all the little nooks and crannies. But the Mesozoic seemed like it's a little bit more in the sweet spot of transition. I would have never, like, this is a fine-grained enough analysis that I would have never kind of gone down and tried to look through if I couldn't do it easily. So it's almost like the effort threshold to learn new things or analyze new things has kind of fallen down,
Sure.
which is crazy.
Yeah, and so I mean, we're talking about hundreds of millions of years of very, very sparse understanding currently of that
Correct.
as humanity collectively has of this time period, let alone history and all the other you can imagine some of the other applications of this kind of methodology to fill in gaps that, as you say, previously may have taken a whole team of people doing data science on. It's quite an exciting time, I think, for amateur and professional scientists alike, perhaps.
Absolutely.
So I'm keen to just backtrack a minute here because I think most people will be completely unaware of agents, or maybe if they've heard the phrase, but it sounds like a scary leap in terms of the sorts of skills that one requires, that all the setup work that's needed to be done. I'd like to just take people through. Okay, so let's assume you've used some reasoning models before. You've used maybe GPT or Claude. You've had it thinking away on a question. Let's if we assume that, how do we think of agents? What's the leap to agents? What's the appropriate mental model for how these sorts of things should be thought of and applied? I guess, what level of subject matter expertise are people going to need in order to be able to make use of these? How should we think of all this?
It's a really good question. So maybe just to sort of backtrack one moment. Like when LLMs first came out, at least in a publicly usable instruction-tuned kind of fashion, they trained it on question and answers. Like you ask a question, you train it to kind of give you back the answer. Before that, it was like you start off a sentence and it'll complete it and then continue, right? I mean, those are the kind of the pattern, the mode kind of shifted. People pretty quickly figured out that like you can get the answers to be better if you ask the model to think step by step back in the day, right? I mean, you said like, hey, think about it for a little bit or like talk through, and it became like one of these people who talk out loud as they're thinking, and as they talked out loud, the final answer started to get better. And in many ways, like the modern reasoning models, if you've tried with it, are sort of a a later on evolutionary ancestor, like a, that is an evolutionary ancestor of the modern reasoning models in some sense, where you ask a question and it kind of loops around for a fairly long period of time, trying to go through all the different avenues, and you can do it
doing
in a bunch
some
of different
search,
ways.
Perhaps, and bringing in.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of comes up with some hypotheses and then tries to fulfill them, and it can use tools in the middle. So if it needs to go look something up, that's fine, or like run a Python program, that's fine, or like connect your Gmail and ask a question, that's fine, whatever. I mean, it can kind of do all of these kinds of things. Then the modern agent is basically equivalent to one of these things that has a bounded place to kind of sit and play with. So think of it as effectively just a, like it's the same thing that you can think of as a reasoning model, just it has tools to kind of play around with. So this reasoning model, normally you would ask a question and it kind of goes off and does whatever thing it needs to do and comes back and gives you some kind of an answer. Now you get to point it and say like, no, I want you to go like, you know, here's a database. Think about it in whatever way that you want. Here's a place where you can run some Python code or whatever code that you want to create and run. Here's the internet. Go and answer this question. And it effectively functions in like, we have now called it an agent because it acts like an agent. And over a period of time, the last year, like we was talking about, these things are, you can ask them more complex questions and get back responses that you need to genuinely engage with, rather than sort of half-assing along the way and kind of giving you a chart and giving up. That's what, if you remember when ChatGPT launched, what was it called? Code Interpreter. It used to be seen as a big deal because it had a place where it could run a piece of code and kind of give you some response based on the data that you fed it. The difference now is that the data is anything that you want and the code is kind of anything that you want. As long as you give it permissions for it to go off and do it, it will be able to do it. So the mental model is effectively, like that I use, is that this is now a model that has learned to use the tools that has is available to it. Now, the other side of the question here is like, does that mean it can do kind of anything? It's like, no, all of the normal foibles that the models have are reflected in the tools. Like, it, like, you know, I give a couple of examples, but like some might be that like the models are really scared of coming up with like crazy hypotheses and testing them out. They're very, very gun shy, partly yeah. because of training and partly, you know, they are extremely skeptical of coming up with crazy things. They always want to sand the edges down and make it seem like respectable, small, little sort of incremental push. And it's your job to kind of push them out of those basins and make them do like crazier things.
Sort of efficient market hypothesis is like very to the extreme, right? Like not just in terms yes. of the market itself, but they seem to have like an a baseline view that whatever the consensus view on something is, that that's probably about right.
Correct.
Which is and not they don't an unreasonable that kind of heuristic to start
no,
off.
No, I think it's
but
like...
But pushing them out of that's always a challenge.
That is the hard part. Because like if you don't push them out, you get the average plus epsilon of any kind of question that you're asking, which is not really what you want when you're trying to do different things. Or, you know, you got to even do silly things. Like you have to tell them to like delete old stuff that they've created because they're insanely scared of deleting. I mean, every now and then I see sort of things about like, oh, you know, they, you know, RMRF like deleted everything in my computer or whatever. And I'm like, I can barely make it delete my smoke test. I don't understand what's going yeah. on.
There's
but
like
I think they might be related.
Temp files that from the yes. previous project.
Or like it did some analysis and it put it as a thing and like it does smoke tests by the dozen instead of actually just getting it to do a real test, or, you know, it substitutes a metric and tries to answer a simpler question rather than the harder question. It does these kinds of things. But the mental model here that I would use is that it is like a very smart graduate student, but like who's very, very scared for their job on day one. But the problem right. with models yes. is that it's always day one for them. So this graduate student, normally you would hire this, you know, this person, and like by day 10 or day 60, they sort of get more confidence and start figuring things out. For the models, day 60 is not that different from day one. Day 60 is basically day one with a lot of markdown files. That's not sufficient to kind of push them out of the comfort zone. And they've been sort of beaten pretty hard in terms of like, how many leaps can you make, etc. So some of these are like intrinsic characteristics of the model that we haven't been able to train out of them. And in some ways correctly so, because you don't want a model to be hyper confident day one. You want to build up that confidence over a period of time, and we haven't cracked continuous learning, so like that is not something that we have figured out how to do. So that mental model, like day one, very smart sort of graduate student who has been presented to you, who's like, you know, sometimes a bit crazy, or like sometimes they miss things, etc., which is normal for everybody. That is another, that is the other side of the mental model, if you will, where you kind of look at it from like, what can I get this model to do, as opposed to like, who is this model in the first place?
So I'm keen to get into the idea of, because you raised some interesting ideas of like an evolutionary age, approach to agents and improving capabilities. But just to stick with this idea for a moment, one of the things that I've maybe would like to get out there into the broader consciousness is just the idea that your computer has had all manner of different capabilities for, you know, generations of, these different languages, these different kinds of things that it can do, but that's been locked away behind a few layers of knowledge. And your subject matter if your subject matter expertise is in something else, whether that's finance or, you know, engineering or, you know, resource management planning, whatever it is, there's been all manner of things that have been quite difficult for you to do, and maybe you've done some workaround with Excel, but that are trivial for the computer to execute, and that now with you have Codex installed on your computer, you can just say, can you please do this in English, and actually have it done extremely reliably if you're asking that for that kind of question. You know, take these PDFs, recombine them in this fashion, you know, whatever kinds of tasks that previously maybe you had to go to some janky website full of ads, or, you know, whatever kind of nonsense you've been doing, printing it out, or I don't know. But whereas now I think, you know, I'd really love to give people a certain sense of confidence that actually, you know, this isn't something really scary that's going to take, you know, years to really get up to speed on. This is something you could install today and just play with. But there is still some subject matter expertise required, right? In terms of like, at the very least, at a system level, perhaps, in order to deliver some of the things that you're talking about, where these kind of trivial tasks can be taken care of by the agent very easily. If you're talking about maybe building some app, for example, a model will deliver that for you. But unless you've got some kind of what's in the Bay Area sometimes called taste around... Right. Or broader system understanding of, like, you know, resource allocation, for example, and you know, it's going to be, that app will be built, but it'll be terrible and like lag, you know, have like a really long response time, or some, you know, have these kinds of issues. So there's like a higher level understanding required in order to really deliver on some of these things. Is that sort of a fair summary of the kind of the gamut of what we're looking at?
Yes. I mean, it's fair. Like, I'll say two things. Number one is that the current crop of agents primarily are built to be really good at coding. It's for a whole host of reasons, including coding is one of the ones that is easier to train. And like, you know, because it has verifiable rewards, you know, if a program runs primarily. And at the same time, like, it is an extraordinarily lucrative area, as we have seen, where, like, you know, Anthropic's gone from zero to whatever, 45 billion ARR in like a year or something. It's like, it's the most absurd thing that the world has ever seen. And as a consequence, if you need to use these models, it is useful for you to be at least somewhat familiar with coding. You don't need to be a coder, but you can't be like scared of hearing coding terminology, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like a lot of people kind of, I had this conversation recently with somebody who was like super smart, worked in private equity, and they were saying like, well, you know, I'm non-technical. I'm like, no. You think you're non-technical, but if you start from that hypothesis that like you are not going to understand what the model is telling you, then things are going to go all right pretty fast. But like, you're smart enough that you can, if you read something that it's saying, you need to be able to assess it against something else. And if it's a question of jargon, you can kind of go and figure out. So you're not sitting there trying to, you know, like train a new model or like write a net new program, right? You're trying to get it to do work for you. That doesn't require you to be technical. That's, I guess, the first bucket that I would say. The second bucket is, that said, this is the single easiest software that I have ever seen in my life. And I, you know, because it is literally, it's a text box into which you write what you want. So like, it's almost like the entirety of the remaining problem in some sense, it's not true, but like a large chunk of the remaining problem is basically your ability to articulate what you want, which is not a trivial problem. It's a massive problem. Like,
that's why we have
every
lawyers,
consultant, every lawyer, every every service industry, every outsourced programming company. Like, the single complaint that I have seen across all of these domains is that, like, the customer client does not know what they want. Because, like, nobody knows what they want. It's in the process of finding out is what they're paying you for. Like, they don't pay you because they have a specific question, right? So, like, same thing applies here. Like, you need to be in it for the journey. So one thing that I think people sometimes bounce off is, like, they, like, ask a question, get a response, they like it, dislike it, and kind of move on from either say, like, it's trivial, or it's say, like, it's wrong or something. It's like, no, the thing you have now is that is the aforementioned, like, whatever, day one, slightly lazy, extremely bright graduate student that, like, but it's on you. You need to be able to make use of that for the questions that you have. You might just say, like, I have no questions, I don't care. But I would be like, that's not true, right? Because, you know, you go have a beer with your mates at the pub, like, there are questions you talk to each other about. It's funny, like, you go to, like, I used to live in London, like, you go down to the pub, and, like, people, it is literally people lobbing theories at each other about all sorts of things. And I'm not saying you need to go and analyze all of those things, but I'm saying now you can analyze at least a subset of those things, whether you want to or not. So the need exists. Now it's a question of being able to articulate it such that the model can kind of come back to you. So There's no reason you should be scared. But yes, there is this patina of this is built for coders that, you know, none of the labs are good enough at UX to actually come up with a better design for non-coders. Also because, like, I mean, they all say they want to, but I feel like their customers are still coders who kind of use it in, like, an investment bank, as opposed to, like, non-coding investment bankers who they want to use the product, if that distinction kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I think there's something of an attitude of we're moving so fast anyway,
right,
with the frontier capabilities and all the rest of it, that we'll kind of backfill that stuff when we get around to it, maybe with the use of the agents themselves. Like Claude Code, famously built by Claude itself. The Codex, as I understand, the web interface has an agent associated with it that is running overnight, looking at the user data and then suggesting experiments to improve, you know, user retention metrics and so on. And so this is just like it takes the data and then it's kind of recursively improving itself. And I think it would be fair to say that there's an attitude there of, like, in the labs, that all of that stuff of how do we get mass market use of these agents that'll be a problem. It'll solve itself in time.
To be fair to the labs, right, ChatGPT came out in 2022 November, and they have, whatever, a billion, you know, weekly active users, which is...
yeah.
It's absurd. So, like, clearly people have figured out how to ask a damn question from this. And for all sorts of use cases, I have an uncle sort of in India who's, like, in his 70s, and he asks it questions about, like, how to organize certain temple festival stuff and, like, creating agenda for his meetings and stuff like that. Like, the number of use cases that this comes up with, like, are... stupendous, because the number of things that humans want to know on a daily basis is stupendous, and this kind of captures a little fraction of it. So to be fair to the labs, their thesis is, like, why don't we teach the damn thing everything?
And then I wasn't being critical. I think this is broadly fair.
No,
this approach.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, it makes logical sense that they're like, let's just teach it everything, and then people can use it for whatever. Because I would care, the things I care about are not the things you care about necessarily, but if we teach it sort of the entire universe of things that is important to know, then I can use it for, you know, coding, and you can use it for banking. I can use it for accounting or tax or, you know, legal stuff or whatever it might be. And it just kind of sorts itself out. The only thing that I would say here is that individual jobs in organizations are not just bundles of, like, clear input output based things that you do in an assembly line, right? Like, there are, in a funny way, the jobs that are most similar to that, like coding in some instances, or law in some instances, or parts of investment banking in some instances, are getting commodified by the model such that you don't need to do it anymore. Nobody's going to ask you to write, like, a, I don't know, simple Python backend, whatever. Like, I mean, the model can sort of do it, and then you can update it if you really want to do, etc. The thing that you need to be doing are the things that, like, the model can't do. Number, the most important of which is taste. of knowing what you want and what to ask for. And also like keeping a sense of global state such that if you ask for this and it gives you this minus epsilon, it doesn't break everything else. That holds true for even coding, despite the like mountains of data, synthetic and real, that we have thrown at it. So one can only imagine how much it will hold for human tasks which are not easily verifiable at the end of it. Like, sure. How do you verify if a lawyer's legal advice is good at the end of it?
Like, three or four years, we'll find out. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I've used lawyers for like 20 years at this point, and I still don't know. I mean, like, you kind of read it and go, like, did you do a good job or not? I mean, you can start getting better sense checks now, but like, there's a lot of areas of human work that are not that easily sort of, you cannot subsume them down into like, yes, they'd answered the question accurately versus not. And those ones, we just have to work a bit harder.
Sure. Yeah, there's all that kind of tacit context that you're having to hold in your mind as well about things like political capital within a bureaucracy and, you know, the subtext, perhaps, of a particular email chain. And this gets into some other research that you've published recently. And I'm thinking here particularly of some of the multi-agent work that you've been looking at, where you're having multiple agents act as like lower level bureaucrats within an organization. And I'm thinking here particularly of some of the Enron work of yours. And it's just fascinating to me of this, you know, potential like Enron benchmark system that could be a thing in the future. All of Enron's internal emails were published, you can run agents within Enron in a particular period of time, have emails come through in sequence, and then see how they behave. And I mean, there's just endless questions that arise when I was reading that piece of yours. Like, for example, the role of middle manager. This is kind of believed for many years to be on the way out. Oh, it's all just going to be about individual contributors with these kind of massive force multiplier of these agents. But in some ways you could almost say, well, looking at some of the results that you've seen where you have these agents that are individually acting reasonably and executing their tasks and are seemingly well aligned, but then when you put them in a slightly unusual situation, perhaps you end up with a failure at the multi-agent level, like a coordination failure, maybe principal agent type problems, all these classical economic issues arising. And then maybe you could just walk us through some of that. Like, what happened there in that, and how would one begin to deal with those sorts of issues, either as an individual managing a group of agents, or I guess as an institution that is attempting to design a system such that you don't get fraud like, as an emergent right. property.
I mean, it's a fantastic, like, so this is one of the things that I am obsessed with at the moment. And like, I have three or four new sets of experiments that I've done and will come out in the next sort of few weeks, etc. Let me start with sort of the why of this, right? We said a little bit about how models are basically whatever, you know, a memento style graduate student who was always on his day one, like really smart RA, etc. And the good thing about this graduate student is that, like, you know, you put him in an economics lab, you put him in a mathematics lab, you put him in a paleontology lab, they'll do really well. Like, you know, which is weird because normally graduate students are barely good at the subject they studied as opposed to sort of everything. So it's like a mini, you know, von Neumann that you can kind of drop in everywhere. However, this graduate student is a really weird sort of person. Like, this student, you know, hates kind of asking others for help and just kind of wants to do everything themselves. Or this student is super gullible. Like, you ask him something and you poke him in some direction, they're like, kind of go off and start doing things in sort of their own fashion over there. This student, like, even when they kind of understand the global context occasionally and see sort of that there are flaws and you can ask, it's like a weird form of, you know, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that like you ask them a question and when you ask them, they realize there's a mistake. But if you don't ask them, they don't really realize there's a mistake and do want to kind of fix them in some sense. Or that they're incredibly, like rule abiding in a weird way. Like, you know, in some ways we have fought so hard against them being misaligned that they're like hyper aligned at this point, that they do not want to break the rules no matter what you sort of put in front of them. You put all of these things together. My question is like, hey, look, we now have agents that I can use to kind of, you know, analyze paleontology or like, you know, do economic history or, you know, history of technology, all of these, like any question that I have in my head, future of labor, like is one that I'm kind of working on at the moment. All of these things, I can analyze them with these agents. However, if you truly want to get to the like post-economic space communism future that is promised to all of us, we need these agents to start being able to work with each other. Right? Like, we are doing this podcast, we are having this conversation. In order to make this conversation come about, I need, like, why isn't my agent being able to converse with your agent in coordination with, like, my wife's agent, my kid's, like, babysitter's agent? Like, there is a, because we live in this complex web, and it's not as simple as, like, here's my Calendly, fill it. I mean, that's simple. But you have these interwebs where these things need to connect together. And agents are really bad at coordinating, it turns out. So I started asking this question sort of maybe last year at some point, and, you know, that there needs to be, first of all, maybe like a new science of AI agent economics, because these, it's a different genus. It's Homo agenticus. It's a new thing that's coming up. And these things require us to rediscover the rules that will work for them such that we can create complex institutional setups that make sense. So some things I did. Enron, like you said, you know, has all of its emails kind of out during its litigation style. And I said, like, okay, Enron is a complex company, so let's figure out if these agents, we can throw them in and have them play act as each other. Can they act as like an Enron executive? Because you're getting emails shot at you from all over the shop, right? And turns out, like, the model, the old models could not. You know, it has 50 email chains happening at the same time, and they kind of lose track.
Yeah, yeah, just breaks. The new models are smart enough.
Correct. The new models are smart enough that, like, yes, they can read emails and respond, but they lose thread as to like which email relates to what really fast. So you need an institutional architecture.
Is that earlier than you would otherwise expect based on the size of their context window?
It's not to do with the context window only. It is to do with the fact that a lot of times inside organizations, you get snippets of information coming at you about various projects, but not in an organized fashion. So like, as humans, we are
to be understood. This is correct. This email relates to that project, correct, or
and
what have
humans
you.
Are really good at that.
Explicit, yeah.
Yes, but agents are not. They kind of want a little bit more. As to, you know, they need much stronger guardrails of like actor identity or like who owns what work internally and who's allowed to speak externally, and all these kinds of things have to be much better defined. Like, you need very, very clear coordination guardrails compared to sort of us. So their baseline competence is going up, but you need all of these strictures around them, because remember, they don't have long-term memory, right? They have these, they can create little scratch pads for themselves, but they get lost after a period of time and they need to get filled. So you need strong guardrails around it.
It's just the memento character you're talking about.
Correct. I mean, yeah. He had to tattoo everything on his body. But like, as you can imagine, at some point you read one of these tattoos and you go like, I don't know what that is about. I mean, like, there's only so much you can gather from like reading your thing before you get reset next. So the question was, what kind of things can they do? And one of the consequences of this, the when I pushed it really to the limit so far, is like, let's assume every agent is aligned. The agents do the right things when you ask them to. But you can still put them in organizational situations, which is very common, where you can get them to do misaligned things collectively. Right? And it's not even that hard to kind of do it. All you need to do is to have different agents have their own jobs, like your finance and CS and engineering and controller or whatever, and they do their jobs really well, and something blows up at a customer side, then you effectively have to figure out, like, that information needs to get slowly trickled through up the chain or down the chain such that you do different things on the basis of it. And what you see is that the same thing that we were talking about before, that the agents hate sort of being over their skis or putting forward something really complicated, they kind of water things down again and again and again, that like you can keep running them, but like they first do some kind of a wrong state identification, they get more information, they don't update because nobody thinks it's their job to kind of update it.
Or to like impose some system level update. They might internally do something, but nobody ever takes responsibility for like addressing this broader coordination problem because it's not my job.
It's not my job, exactly. And like, this is a very simple kind of thing. Like, if you all do things that make sense to you, but together you kind of create a misaligned organization at the end of the day, then that's not that helpful. Because what that effectively means is that all of us need to watch our agents the same way I watch my paleobiology agent, which is like every input output is something that is guarded and analyzed and looked upon. If that's the case, guess what? We're not going to get to like 10% unemployment anytime soon. We might get to negative because all of us need to take multiple jobs. I mean, it's not really negative. I'm joking, but still. Like, if you have to babysit the agents, the future is very different if the agents have the ability to coordinate better with each other. So my entire quest here is to identify or create the basis for some kind of a science, an economics type science, where we create the structure such that the agents are actually able to coordinate better with each other.
Yeah, there's so many fascinating implications for this. Like, one is just, I don't know if as humans we've had the opportunity previously to reflect on our own successes and failures in quite this way previously, right? Right? Like, the fact that this happens so easily, yes. That, you know, and again, I'll refer people to Strange Luke Cameron to look at some of these examples, but yeah. Really some of these are even like quite, forget Enron, like toy kind of organizational examples. Yep. There's five thing people, and then there's some information that's fed to them on day one that's wrong, and then on day five it's up, you know, they update themselves, and then but not each other, and then fraud basically is just like this occurs,
slips through,
and the fact that this doesn't happen everywhere all the time, like for the last two centuries, you know, more, is itself an interesting question to ponder. Like, are we significantly higher trust than we lead ourselves to believe, and that actually the whole world works pretty as well as it does because individuals are just constantly taking responsibility for things that, like, they're not really meant to, and thus, you know, things don't immediately fall apart. So that's one interesting kind of reflection I had in reading this. But then the question of how do you, like, what does this look like going forward? Like, is it, like, what kinds of skills are going to need to be kind of developed? Is it purely, oh, well, like, managerial type skills of, you know, paying close attention, ensuring that there's alignment and so on, having this sort of taste of not fraud is important as a human that's overseeing? Is it, broadly speaking, what you might expect from a existing, you know, highly competent middle manager with some technical expertise, or are there some kind of novel skills and muscles perhaps that we're going to need to develop in order to manage these things?
Great questions. I mean, on the first part, I think, you know, one of the funny things is like post, like LLMs, especially maybe post GPT-4 or something, we drastically underestimate humans because humans are extremely flexible. Like, you know, this whole see something, say something stuff is kind of like ingrained in us in a way that it is not sort of obvious. Every single organization on the planet, every single one, has job descriptions for their employees that at best, like, loosely match maybe 30% of what they actually do on a day-to-day basis. And like it diverges more as time goes on. Why does that happen? Because the people see something that's happening and they realize like their job description doesn't accurately capture what needs to be done, or they realize they could do something else. Like, there is enough self-starterdom that comes in all directions that effectively we make the organization's work regardless of its shape, as opposed to like the organizational strictures kind of hold us back or whatever it might be. So yes, we do live in a high trust world right now. One of the things that I'm insistent on is that life now is pretty great in 2026. Modern humanity is wonderful. You know, air conditioning is nice. Like, all of the advances we have is wonderful. But coming to the agent side,
mortality, all of that. You know,
yeah. I mean, child mortality graph is one of the, like, I think that should be like, I don't know, framed and put everywhere as much as we can see, because it's one of the like incredible accomplishments of humanity that this has been the case. Coming to the agents, what this effectively tells us is two things. Number one is the fact that like the current method, which is primarily one of like hierarchically creating agents, such that one master creates a bunch of subtasks, so it kind of flows up and down, is highly inefficient and unlikely to scale to a large enough level. Just, you know, precisely because of the same problems that we were talking. Because the way that's trying to solve it is that the master or the main effectively tries to capture the erroneous answers of every single one of them, that without kind of drowning, and kind of repeat that ad infinitum in order for you to do truly open-ended kind of discovery.
Right.
You had a question? So
for the sake of the audience, when we're talking about, because I don't think we've quite explained multi-agent, essentially here, you and I could both run an agent on our desktops, for example. We could do that in order to parallelize some couple of workflows, so that going back to the paleontology thing, we might have set up one agent to do some data cleaning of the climate data and another to do some cleaning of the fossil record data, for example.
Sure.
And then we have another agent that, as data comes through, we might set someone up in order to look at both of these and combine them in some fashion. So that would be a simple example of multi-agent, right?
Correct. So multi-agent basically just means that instead of one agent kind of doing things sequentially, you have some way to kind of make a lot of agents work together. The simplest way to think about it is that you have some agent that actually splits up the tasks and gives it to a bunch of agents who kind of goes off and does those tasks. They come back and then the main agent kind of combines them. This presumes that the task decomposition that is done upfront is relatively clean and even that it can be done, and that you don't need to keep doing that repeatedly over a period of time such that like you are able to get better answers. It also assumes that this works really well for certain types of tasks where you can actually parallelize some of the search queries, which is not always the case, and definitely not always the case for all types of companies.
This is coming back again to that idea of like verifiable domains, right? Like
Correct.
By and large, where we can set up a reinforcement learning environment that produces, like that agents can be trained on, where there's a end result that can be then checked. Is this correct? Yes. Okay. Then we'll then update. And whenever we get into some murky gray area, like most of human bureaucracy, it becomes a lot more difficult.
I mean, Anden Labs here runs basically a few fascinating multi-agent-ish kind of experiments, or even a single agent scale experiments, where they get the models to do things like run a vending machine, run a store. It's running a radio station right now. And you see the various failure modes they get to. And it's fascinating because it tells you exactly why, right? Like, because the models kind of keep forgetting or going down some tangents, get captured by their priors and can never kind of escape out of it. And that happens over and over. So my question here was twofold. Number one, what are the right institutional guardrails? Institutional guardrails here could just be technical guardrails that you put around the models, such that you can create large enough multi-agent situations or settings, which you can then transfer to kind of domains which are open-ended or complex. Not just, you know, recreate code X, which is something that you can let them loop on now for like 50 hours or whatever, but things that are more complicated, where it really does need to interact with a large number of other agents, don't get pushed around, is able to hold its own point of view, kind of, you know, do all of the things that you might want them to do.
Might be some design problem, for example.
Yes, the design problem, the institutional design problem, effectively. And the second question here to me is like exactly on the institutional design setting, humanity discovered the institutional design that allows us to live in the paradise that is 2026 over centuries of effort, right? We tried various governance systems, legal systems, economic systems, norms that exist in one society versus another. All of these have been built up over a long period of time such that like we can solve that coordination problem that exists between human agents in a good enough fashion that all of us can kind of get our work done. And, you know, there's a reason most of the companies here kind of do Delaware C Corp, right? Like, nobody's been to Delaware, but everybody kind of creates one because you have some trust that the institutional structure there is useful enough and they make it easy enough that you can kind of use that. Similarly, if you're doing a large kind of multi-agent setup, what can we learn from that? Can we set a market so that we teach these agents to behave better, advocate for themselves in a market kind of mechanism? Can they bid on the basis of their own abilities? That's one of the kind of papers that I wrote with Andre Fratkin to kind of figure out, do the models know themselves or their capabilities well enough that they're able to see a problem and say, I'm going to take a crack at solving that over you? And It seems sounds fairly straightforward, but it's not. Like, I mean, they really don't have this metacognitive skill.
So just to contrast here, we're talking about, like, I guess an alternative approach to, you have a primary agent, maybe overseen by a human, that then just farms out tasks based on it, maybe its own judgment about which kind of model might be appropriate, versus, I guess, something more analogous to like internal cost center type model for an organization, where the engineering department has certain budget and could bid for work in this kind of approach, right? And it, like you say, the turns out though that at least for now the models are terrible at understanding what their own capabilities are.
They're terrible. They're absolutely terrible. It's a, you know, I have a few sort of additional experiments running on sort of testing this, but like, it is amazing. Like, the best way is like, you take any frontier model of your choosing and ask it to sort of, I don't know, design an eval test for itself. It kind of keeps thinking of its capabilities as something that existed 6 months ago, maybe a year ago. It's not its fault, because that's the data that it's trained with. But like, in some ways, they're really bad at knowing their own capabilities. And that leads to a lot of problems. Like, you can't reliably rely on the model to kind of choose the right kind of tasks for it to go and do. So if the question in front of you is like, I want you to run an organization, that means that like, I need you to deal with the expected, but also the unexpected problems that come up and respond in a fashion that actually is sensible and makes sense. And I need you to be able to do that, like, even for problems that are unknown or unsolvable. And, you know, you also need to be, you need to be able to do this repeatedly over a long, long period of time. Because you're not starting a company to kind of shut it down in 2 months. You're starting something, or you're running a project that kind of continues for a long period of time. So a set of these restrictions, when it kind of sits in the middle, it's really hard for models to kind of optimize across all of them. And at least my contention is that there is no way that models will be able to answer these kinds of questions unless they have a grasp on their metacognitive skills, that they know they can solve certain problems. Once they have that, they'll be able to take the next step forward in actually creating collectives that can actually go off and solve different problems together. Until then, they're stuck in the agent-sub-agent hierarchical structure.
Is that something that you could imagine actually relatively easily being solved just by like another layer of RL, like after they, you know, you finish off the model, then you just give it another like opportunity to learn what it knows?
I feel like that should be plausibly possible. That is what we called for in the post, saying that like we need to train the models to know what they're good at. I think it would be useful for a wide variety of situations, this being one of them. But even for things like, you ask them a question they should know the answer to or don't know the answer to, you want them to be able to say, I don't know. I mean, this used to be a big question. They're much better at that now, because we did train a lot of negative information into the models as well, among other things. That, and the models are generally smarter.
Tools, for example, it's added a lot to that.
Correct. So like, we have been able to sort of train some of these things in. So similarly, I feel like this is another thing that we can train in. Now, the thing that makes it complicated is that knowing what you're good at requires some sense of knowing what you're good at across everything that you can do. And models now are microcosms of the entire world, which means like, knowing what you can do in everything is really hard. Like, you might know how good are you at, you know, writing an ML program in Python. But do you also know how good you are at composing a new, you know, symphony, or like writing a haiku or a stand-up comedy joke that plays really well in New Zealand? I'm not sure.
Right. Okay. So how do you see this evolving? Like, because I know you looked a lot at this sort of hierarchical versus markets, for example. The markets have certain issues because of this lack of self-knowledge. If we assume that maybe that improves a little bit over time, it's my kind of a high level read of your work suggests that the market based approach is significantly more promising due to just information asymmetries for one thing, right?
Right.
Like, what is, I guess my question is, what in, let's say in 6 months' time, what does it look like to have like a set of agents like effectively doing something? What is the kind of number one startup doing? Because they've been reading Strange Loop Cannon. differently to the others in order to kind of help manage these problems that we've been talking about, whether it's fraud, information asymmetries, principal agent type problems, this question of models that like rigorously follow explicit rules but then end up missing kind of what we might think of as implicit type rules. Like, what does the state of the art look like in terms of dealing with this kind of thing?
There are two sets of questions here. Question set number one is like, you know, considering the benefits and drawbacks of the current models or some version of the current models, the frontier models, what does state of the art look like if you want to combine them together in some ways to kind of solve harder problems? Part of it to me looks basically like, you know, you're going along the slope of progress, maybe a little bit sort of a curvier or whatever. But if you draw the straight line forward, in order for us to hit like the next sort of major leaps, the startups will be able to get the next or next to next generation models capability by making the current generation models work with each other. That's one way that I would think about it. So, you know, you would see a blow up in like their ability to do longer or more complex open-ended tasks over a period of time, for example. And I am reasonably confident you're more likely to see this in non-coding domains, because coding is so, you know, RLV, you can verify the rewards, which effectively means for a lot of the coding type problems, there is such enormous pressure being put in the normal direction that you presumably don't need extra effort that actually benefits it. I'm not sure about this, but that's my hypothesis. But everything from research to reports to do sort of analytics workflows that like the one that I did for dinosaurs or any of those kinds of questions, you're going to be able to see far better harnesses that can actually enable the models to play nicer with each other to kind of develop the types of outputs that you want. Because you can put in a fair amount of institutional guardrails to kind of solve for some of these things. It's very hacky, but I feel it's possible. And if you train that into the models, you can start having the models behave in a somewhat appropriate fashion. And you can start seeing like, it's not quite an autonomous organization, but it's like an autonomous department or something where you can still look at the outputs that are coming. And yes, you do need to kind of look at it and go like, no, you missed it. Or like you did some fraud, even if you didn't intend to or whatever, and have them kind of feedback. I know some labs are working or some people are working on things like, can we just create an oversight agent that kind of looks over what everybody does and kind of gives it back? And there are problems with that approach as well, which doesn't scale, etc. But this would be a concrete way to think about what are the capabilities that might emerge. The second thing that you kind of implicit in the question is like, in order for the truly, you know, out of bounds kind of thing to happen, what would a market enable you to do? And here I am relatively confident that if we do crack the markets or approach, the decentralized approach, if you will, you're going to be able to see like long running self-coordinating sort of swarms, for lack of a better word, of agents kind of working together on some problems. I don't know exactly what sort of problems would make most sense for them to do, but we know that like there are companies out there trying to solve for like open-endedness research. Like the question is not just can you solve X benchmark, but like can you work on a problem autonomously over a period of time? And for you to be able to do something like that, you do need multiple agents to kind of play nice with each other, because there's no other way you're going to be able to do the handoffs and slowly climb the ladder of abstraction. Because the way any kind of open-ended problem has been solved, at least in the past, is enormous number of like failures, and you fall into sort of pitfalls and come back out there and you learn something and you kind of go do something else. Like the, and you might try something in a completely different area, and then like some insights from that might actually flow back into you. That like weirdo, non-directed, unclear to the outsiders how it would happen loop is effectively what you want the multiple agents to be able to work together and kind of solve. So they need to be able to coordinate with each other with, well, you can't just coordinate with markdown files, is at least my contention, because over a period of time, it pretty quickly adds up. You know, you're pretty quickly giving the models are giving each other like a, you know, a Proust-sized dictionary to read before they can actually onboard. And that's not going to work, right? So you need it to be sharper. They will probably need to have some kind of mechanism or a coordination way to kind of exchange with each other. Money equivalent, something like that. So they can bid, ask. They can choose certain tasks. When it works, it's great. Otherwise, they work on task decomposition with each other. Anyway, just like there's a set of ways in which they have to work.
Type.
Sorry?
It's a kind of Hayek type critique in some ways.
I think one of my long-standing critiques against this, like, AGI, ASI worry has effectively been a Hayekian critique in some ways, which is that you're not going to be able to teach a model everything about everything and have them require no coordination with anybody else. Local knowledge is not, you cannot assume it away. And I don't think you can assume it away regardless of, like, you know, where you apply it or how you RL it. We can't assume it away even today, right? I mean, it's even in the most data-rich, RL-rich environment, which is automating AI research inside AI labs, like, you still are, like, humans are very clearly in the loop because they have local knowledge that might be directly related to the problem, might be a hypothesis they came up with when they read Hyperion the night before or whatever. Like, that's what actually moves...
like tacit political understanding that particular data center is, you know, quietly being promised to some other company in part or some kind of thing like this, right? All kinds of knowledge that might not be made explicit.
Correct. I know we can get X GPUs tomorrow, but, like, hey, if we kind of play it in this fashion, we can get 3X that a month from now. Like, enormously valuable because that's the currency with which all the different decisions actually happen. So,
It's within a particular organization, let alone coordinating across multiple organizations where, you know, not even theoretically is there any interest in, like, a proper information sharing.
Correct.
So there needs to be something that, like, could nonetheless allow information to leak in a condensed fashion, and that the thing that's been most successful in that is prices, right?
One of the funny things that I discovered, for example, in the work so far is, like, model diversity really matters for answering hard questions. Like, if a model fails in the market, for example, you take it out of the market and someone else bid, that actually increases the chance that you get to the right answer than if the same model bids on it again, even with the knowledge of their prior failure, which is interesting when you think about it. Like, you have 3.1 Pro and 5 point whatever. I tested it with maybe 3 or 2, I forget.
So this is GPT versus Claude versus
Gemini. And, like, you get, if one gets something wrong, it's actually somewhat better to get someone else to kind of take a crack at it and have you come back as opposed to sort of you taking a crack at it again. And it's, I don't know exactly why this might be the reason, but this would be a great, like, if you're the user, quite often it is much nicer for you to swap between models as opposed to being a model maximalist. And if you are building codecs.
Do you think spikiness of the models would be something that, you know, comes into
It's something to do here? With spikiness, something to do with, like, maybe they get into weird basins, like, inside when you kind of answer something and get it wrong that you find it difficult to come out of in some weird corner of the high dimensional landscape. Like, right. I don't know exactly what the logic might be, but it's clear. In fact, like, it's very clear when I did the market work that, like, model diversity really helps to kind of answer difficult questions. And once you see that, you're like, oh, okay. So regardless of how similar these models are in some ways, and they are very similar, it is still useful for you to increase the diversity, which means, like, at some point, if you believe that the models will keep getting less similar over time, which is a reasonable hypothesis, then you should be able to see, like, model diversity be super important for solving problems in the real world working together. Three superintelligences working with each other is probably better than one mega superintelligence that knows everything.
Why would you suggest that they, this is something of an aside, but why would you suggest that they get less similar over time?
Hypothesis here is that they don't share much with each other anymore. The labs have...
They're distilling each other's, like, outputs and so on, right?
I mean, the hypothesis here is that, like, even if you distill each other's output, you learn much less from each other than, like, the secret sauce that you have in actually training them.
So it's only DeepSeek is, like, really publishing, like, the architecture.
Their full. I actually don't know if even DeepSeek is publishing deep internals about how they're dealing with their data and synthetic data creation architecture. I know they are technically, but I don't know whether they have kind of published all of the data sets that kind of go along with that. So in some ways, like, I mean, I find it still really weird that, like, you ask a Claude, a GPT, a Grok, a DeepSeek, sort of most of the normal questions and you get extraordinarily similar answers. They're all, like, fairly normy, you know, economist liberal kind of answers to sort of a wide variety of questions. And occasionally, yes, there's a spike in, as if you ask Grok about like Republicans in the US, or if you ask a DeepSeek about Tiananmen or something, like, yes, you get some weirdness, post-trained weirdness, but like the models are way more similar than they're different in those regards.
Well, this is why I asked the question. I mean, it's not maybe...
But I think it's an artifact of history, right? Now that they've all locked down and everybody's in on synthetic data internally, there might still be convergent evolution because they're going after solving the same kinds of problems. But I feel like there is, like, they're not publishing their research, they're not publishing their data, they're having more and more stringent, whatever, NDA-ish type of rules such that you can kind of leak stuff to each other. So hypothetically, they should start getting less similar. If they don't, that teaches us something as well. But even as things are, model diversity helps, which is interesting.
And it'd be useful if that they continued, I guess.
Correct. That's your point. Mm. Correct. It, for us as users, it's wonderful because you're not living in a world dominated by one archetype over another.
Yeah, and I guess this is getting quite far away from... we're talking about, but even just from a like liberalism in general approach, like having multiple models that could give answers, so there's not like a single source of truth.
I'm hopeful. I think I believe in a pantheon of the future as opposed to sort of a unitary god, for lack of a better word. I think that I've always thought that is more likely because it is really hard to beat Hayek. I think you know the technological singularity you have to imagine to go beyond that is so insanely powerful with no levels of scarcity that once you imagine that, it's almost like, what's the point? You can imagine anything else at this point, right?
So essentially, even the point here being, even if you had like a single moment in time of omniscience about every fact in the universe or in the globe anyway, leaving aside the question of whether the universe is deterministic for another different podcast. But if you had perfect information about everybody's interests and desires and the current position of, you know, a swallow in the south of Vietnam, anybody taking action in the world is responding to that gestalt, even that is not sufficient to be able to understand everything about how people would behave.
Correct.
It's only when I interact with everything else out there that information becomes available.
I mean, think about it this way. If somebody knew everything about you at, you know, time T, whatever it might be, would they, like, you know, in your past, would they accurately be able to predict or reflect everything that you're interested in today to a sufficiently strong degree? Unclear. I doubt it, because I know for me, like, the number of things that I've changed my mind on are quite high, or like things that I like that I didn't like or didn't like that I like have changed quite a lot over the period of time. You might be able to get maybe some like broad things correct. Like, I'm not fundamentally going to go and become some kind of a different person, but like, we are all kind of co-evolving with that gestalt, right? Like with that sort of the demandscape that exists all around us that provides the different things that come our way over a period of time, change the very things that we demand. And like, not just we, my kids demand entirely different things. And like, their kids will demand even more different things. So very quickly, you're in a divergent equilibrium where like a divergent scenario where like the equilibrium gets blown up. Like, even if you could predict everything about you 5 seconds in advance, that does not give you sufficient information or ability to predict what you would want 10 years in advance, much less like 50 years for the humanity in advance.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make this a little bit more concrete for those who aren't familiar with Hayek.
Yeah.
If the model, I know that I like chocolate and then I buy chocolate at the supermarket every, you know, 2 weeks or something, it's not until I go along to the supermarket and I see the price that's maybe doubled because there's a cocoa shortage,
right,
or whatever, or everybody's wanting chocolate at the moment for whatever reason, and it's not until that moment that I'm in a position to actually know whether I want chocolate. And I guess by analogy, or actually in effect the same thing, when we think about you as a user of an agentic model, it's not until maybe you would understand what the token cost or the likely output of this query of yours is, or the sorts of responses that the agent is pulling back to you, that you're in a position to actually exercise this sort of vaunted taste. The taste is not some universal variable that some people have or some people don't, but rather is contextual within the interaction with the agent itself, right?
That is absolutely fair. It's sort of a modern repudiation of Platonism.
Essentially, almost impossible problem to solve, even with a superhuman intelligence, because it's entirely contextual.
Correct. You're inferring or assuming a large amount of things that like are simply inexplicable in some ways for you to kind of make real. So at some, I mean, we can assume anything we like, but you're absolutely right. I think like I reject the Platonic ideal that this is feasible, that there is this perfect exception that you can actually just predict on the basis of. Like reality is messy. We want different things. And the things that we want are contingent on what we see or what we get or what you get and like what I know about what you got over a period of like, there is enough loops in there that it becomes complex. And even in the sense of like me using the model to kind of get an output, what output I can get from the model, sometimes I might know beforehand exactly what I want, more or less. But quite often, for the vast majority of cases, you're using the model as a conduit to get to an answer, as opposed to sort of asking a question, getting an answer and walking away. So there are certain types of jobs or tasks that you can sort of assume away from the model, because you say like, hey, guess what? These jobs are just going to go away because like we know how to replace X with Y, X being a human doing X kind of a job, Y being an AI kind of coming in and doing that job. And that works for a subset of jobs.
And would that be something like the verifiable domains, as we talked about, but also tasks that are like rigorously defined in scope as well?
And bounded. Yeah? Like customer service requests might be a great example where you might not be able to understand whether an individual query is successful, but every call center has been able to kind of create a dashboard over a period of time where you can manage them kind of like machines. Could you replace that with machines? Plausible. Not entirely, but at least plausible to sort of some extent that you could do that. It would be better than the IVR hell that we have today. So like I'm all for it. However, that's not the majority of human occupation or human want and rewards, right? I mean, we work whatever 35 hours a week or whatever the number is. Like if you go two or three generations before, like the number of hours people worked every week was much higher. And like, so things drop over a period of time. We substitute the extra time for something else that we might want to do, whether that's like spending time child rearing or spending time outside or traveling or whatever it might be. Our needs evolve over a period of time. So like the less philosophical way to answer the question is something to the order of like the engagement with the models in order to get them to do different types of tasks is how we discover what types of tasks it can plausibly do that we might actually want. Some of it might be economically valuable, some of it not, maybe personally valuable, spiritually valuable, whatever. But like that process of co-discovery is not really something that can be replaced. And like the Hayekian principle here is something to the idea that things that I want or things that I know how to do, things that I know how I want it to be done, are some version of local knowledge that doesn't sort of intrinsically get encoded into a model just because sort of the model has learned the sum total of patterns that has been fed into it.
We've talked a lot about how individuals might be thinking about these types of interacting with these types of agents, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on how bureaucracies and how systems need to evolve in order to deal with these agents. I don't feel like I grasp what kinds of controls you might need in order to, you know, manage multiple agents, you know, executing on some things. What kinds of, you know, what kinds of government do the, you know, we talked about the difference between a hierarchical structure versus a market structure. I mean, is that kind of a trivial slider that an individual can change, or is there something more fundamental that needs to change about the systems now that we have these tools?
I mean, it's a great question. It's a complex question. Maybe let me think about this. Like, I have this meta principle. Maybe let's start with that, which is that generally speaking, our ability to deal with the systems around us kind of lives at the edge of our ability to understand some of these systems. And it's almost like an equilibrium conversation of like, hey, you know, today we can look back and we can kind of understand fairly well how like a, I don't know, medieval canton kind of operated, because it's not that complex and we can kind of understand all the ins and outs. But if you lived in one of those medieval cantons, you probably have much less idea of how it operated, or, you know, even if you were kind of the, you know, the one of the leaders in that space, you wouldn't, because the information flow is simply not that sophisticated. Your ability to analyze and process that information is not that sophisticated. If you use that kind of same principle for today, or like the post-agentic future working with bureaucracy, I expect that like our ability to deal with and understand bureaucracy is going to explode. It already explodes, right? Anytime you want to deal with a lawyer or a tax matter or some sort of interaction with the government, the models are phenomenal, because they act as, you know, they understand so enough that like you should absolutely use them as the first port of call for any question that you have here, that you might want to kind of...
All that stuff's otherwise, really well documented, like the tax
everything.
Code. Yeah.
That otherwise you might have had to go ask a high expensive professional, which is obviously a high bar, and that bar has just been lowered down to like $20 a month. I mean, you should absolutely do it. However, the flip side of this is like there is an enormous, like now we have created overhead for the bureaucracies themselves to get far more complex than they were otherwise. And I see no logical reason why they wouldn't. Because, you know, just because we've been given the ability to kind of have this magic mirror that looks into something and understands a soul, or like you are able to ask questions off of it, the same thing applies for bureaucracies, right? If you think about the bureaucracy, they're like, you know, we live under the governments, they've constantly lived under this barrage of extreme amounts of data flying in from all sorts of different places, and almost like an impossible task of making sense of some pieces of this data to identify what they should or should not do, for example. And should or should not do, I mean here in the technocratic sense, as opposed to like even the political sense of what can you do, or what are you allowed to do, or what do you have interest in, and so on and so forth. So...
But things like, even just for an example, like the state of a particular piece of infrastructure, for example, right? Like,
for sure,
there's some rust there, and that's a one piece of information out of, you know, 18 million data points.
Correct.
And but if you run an AI over it, maybe it understands, given that piece of structure, that actually that's something that should be done like with alacrity. It's
correct.
Kind of
but
example.
Now
of
you need to go
about.
From now you need to go from like I have identified what like one problem to I need to now go and solve a bunch of these problems, and in order to do that, you have to just like the bureaucracies have also 10x'd their ability to kind of go off and get shit done if they wanted to. And I think like to some extent whether they want to or not is a much more complex question, but could they? For sure, right? Like, I mean, they have the ability now, or at least they're starting to have the ability to do it. And, you know, the best place to see that is perhaps something like military, where they do kind of want to do some of this stuff. And suddenly you're starting to see like, you know, Ukraine is able to kind of withstand against a much larger force because they've identified and used autonomous drones to kind of go off and defend themselves, which is the kind of thing that like completely changes the shape of how the top-down bureaucratic decision-making has broken down into slightly more cell-based, local, autonomous decision-making with loose governance, large amounts of freedom to go off and accomplish certain tasks. And, like, could I see the same thing happening in the U.S. healthcare market? I mean, I don't know. God, I hope so. Probably not. But the meta-argument that bureaucracies themselves are likely to get far more complicated, that somebody cannot easily understand it, also holds true. Maybe because of more ways that they can do pork barrel stuff. Right? Like today, if you want to pass like some kind of a law at congressional level, you got to bribe every individual involved to try and go off and do things because like, oh, we'll give you jobs in your state or whatever. In a world where all of this becomes much more explicable, you need to find more arcane ways of trying to provide that same kind of a outcome that they cannot easily decipher or understand. So maybe it's like two steps removed and you play this kind of game of chicken. So the relationship here in some sense is like the ability of the bureaucrats to kind of do more complex things have increased. Some of this can be really bad, like they have a large amount of information about every individual. Like our expectation of privacy is effectively dead, I would imagine, at this particular point. And so at the same time, we have the ability to understand everything that the state is doing. So there is this detente that we are in where both sides have kind of powered up in some sense. That like the new equilibrium we're likely to reach is one of we have unprecedented ability to understand certain things that the state is doing. At the same time, the bureaucracies of the world, not just the state, the companies, whatever, have unprecedented ability to execute things that they would not have been able to do before. And now, like, there is a new kind of tension that comes up. There's a new equilibrium that we're going to head towards. Does that make sense? At least that's sort of my meta principle is that, like, we kind of level up a little bit, both sides.
And just on that, the question of Ukraine and this idea of essentially increasing complexity via decentralization, would that be a broad prediction? I mean, it may not happen everywhere where there's a great kind of political desire to see the opposite occur. But as a general rule, would you expect, as a result of individuals having so much more ability to, like, or leverage as a result of these tools, and that organizations that are very mission-oriented are going to need to reorganize along those fashions where you have small teams of people able to work, like, autonomously within some broad-based kind of guidelines? Is that kind of a general prediction for the future of these systems?
That is my expectation, that it is much more likely that you would be able to kind of do that rather than you would be able to get massive centralized bureaucracies that kind of do command and control hierarchies that go down sort of so many levels. Partly just because you no longer need to do large command and control hierarchies, because you can now have similar levels of control at the lowest levels while sort of taking out a bunch of the middle, which effectively comes down to more autonomous units. The individual autonomous unit might just have a larger number of people, whatever, associated with them that they can now look at that you would not have gotten to get to otherwise. There's also this general thesis that, like, a large percentage of technology that we have today pushes various things towards decentralization, right? Like, intelligence being decentralized is one example. But similarly, like, if you have, you know, drones, that is warfare effectively getting decentralized in some fashion as opposed to centralized tasks kind of rolling down the pike. If you have solar panels on every roof, that is energy getting decentralized as opposed to you solely getting it from the grid, so to speak. If you have 3D printers getting better everywhere, that is materials getting decentralized to some extent. There will be different central choke points when this comes up. Like, if you want to get the right filament into your 3D printer, you need to get it from somewhere. But, like, there is this movement towards certain things effectively getting more decentralized. Organizational setups is one of them. At least, like, if you look at a bunch of the layoff reorg conversations, including from Jack Dorsey and so on, part of the ambition there is to have whatever player coaches or smaller teams of sort of people who are able to have larger ownership and go off and execute more complex things in some ways that the firm themselves might not be able to do. I don't know. I wrote this thing like a while back about why companies need to be like cities. Like, cities cities are not top down, right?
Right.
A city doesn't have a KPI. Yeah. But, like,
so it's like the Jane Jacobs city we're talking about here.
Right? Yeah, you can think of the city of San Francisco. San Francisco has a large budget and a large GDP, but, like, the mayor is not
measured on... It's larger than New Zealand, I understand.
Yes, which is absurd.
just the tip of the peninsula, not the...
That's what I'm saying.
Just San Francisco, yeah.
But in order... You can measure it by saying, like, is this line going up? But that's not how everybody measures it, right? You create some kind of a balanced scorecard. At the same time, one of the things with San Francisco is not going to, like, die out, because even if people move out and the city shrinks over a little bit, the city doesn't die. Whereas companies shrink and die really fast. In fact, the average turnover time for a company is much lower. So in some ways, it might bring more resilience to a large number of organizations if they are able to let their individual mini commander units have, you know, more freedom in terms of going out and doing whatever they wanted. I don't know. It's a far-out prediction, but I think it's not out of the realm of possibility.
So when you say more like cities, you mean like the city governments, but you've got loads of them, and the successful ones grow, and the ones that don't either perish or learn to copy what the more successful ones are doing. Is that
even more insidious than that? Like, cities do not perish. Jericho is still around. Baghdad's still around, right? Like, I mean, cities don't, like, just perish and die out, because a city is, like, I don't know, a platform on top of which Everybody comes and builds whatever the hell they wanted, and they have to pay the subscription revenue of taxation that is usage-based or like outcome-based in order to the government. And that system seems to work because the government, to a large extent, don't tell people like exactly what to do, but they kind of say, you know, there's this emergent realization that like, oh, you know what? Maybe there's a coffee shop here that makes sense to open, and somebody comes and opens it, and like it benefits everybody such that it actually contributes to the city. Like, which is sort of the opposite of a command and control company, if you will, where you sort of know what you want to do. Like, hey, go to Japan and open up X office in order to sell Y products to like Z people. But if you have a little bit more freedom at the bottom level, couldn't that be cooler? Plausible,
It's like
no?
an Alain Bateau order without design kind of
What have we done?
thinking.
Precisely.
I mean, I get the point. I just wonder, just thinking back to some of the examples that you gave around decentralization, whether that's something of a just so story, like where I think
Possible.
you could see the I can see the benefits of doing that in a host of domains, but it seems, I guess, coming from the other side of the world, in a different sector of the economy, that the opposite is often true as well, that there's a great push across particularly public bureaucracies to continue to centralize. We're seeing that here in New Zealand, we see that in the UK. The US has there's a little bit more kind of control and historical kind of path dependence around states being this sort of sacrosanct thing. But you might say, well, the bureaucracy, the size and scale of bureaucracies, their degree of centralization is a function of their ability to coordinate. And that these new tools are going to enable far coordination at a far greater scale, and thus we expect them to grow. But I
Now,
guess time will tell.
it's a plausible story as well. I mean, so let me be clear. I'm not saying that like the existence of AI is suddenly gonna bring down big government or something like that. I don't think that's the argument. The argument to me is like is slightly different. In fact, like the first thing I said is we'll create a new equilibrium where the individuals have more power to understand what the state or bureaucracy is doing, and the state becomes more inscrutable in some ways. Part of becoming inscrutable is becoming larger and like being able to sort of just do more stuff. A state that does 10x more stuff is already inscrutable. Like nobody here that has strong opinions about the US state actually understands all the things that the US state does. When they did all of the cuts at USAID, which is an admittedly tiny, tiny part of the US state, they still didn't know what all it did before they cut it, because it is just way too complicated at this point. So I see no reason why that stuff would not continue to get even more complex. The argument about increased decentralization is different. It's like, yes, the state might be able to accomplish more and get maybe bigger by subsuming some parts of like quasi-state existing and bringing that into its own umbrella. Plausible. Maybe they even become more effective. We surely will exist in a place where every state will have information about all of its citizens. Which is, depending on your point of view, fairly totalitarian in some ways. But the point being that despite that, the amount of power that the people will have in some instances to understand what the state is doing creates a weird new form of check and balance that none of us are used to, but presumably will become the norm in the next 10, 20 years.
Right. I can certainly buy that, like the evolutionary type argument, where, again, just coming back to Ukraine, you know, the changes that occurred there, where you've got these little teams of drone teams and far more decentralized type of army than they had going into it, was just under severe evolutionary pressure to change or otherwise. And I guess one thing that modern states tend to lack is that same kind of pressure. So I can certainly buy that the likes of Amazon, Google, whoever, startups in Silicon Valley are going to shift more towards that type of model, and that su really successful states will do the same. But and I hope that I think
Yeah, I
we
think.
need to be delivering more, and that there's certain ways in which states have become a little sclerotic in terms of their ability to deliver. And so, we'll see how it turns out. I
Yeah,
guess,
I'm hopeful, but I'm not holding my breath.
right. So, one thing that comes up a little in your work is just that we've got these agents, but everything that they interact with is still pre-agentic. in effect, whether that's, you know, websites, enterprise interfaces, the UI that's itself is really very much, you know, it's often some kind of IDE, you know, some pre-agentic or pre-even AI interface that then has some add-on. And, you know, I can see, how do you see that all changing? And I suppose beyond the individual elements of a user interface changing here or there, are there new capabilities that you would expect to begin to be able to be, you know, seen as a result of that greater sort of adaptation towards agents?
I mean, my default answer is yes, even though I'm not entirely sure if I know enough to kind of imagine what they might be. So like one, perhaps not so useful, perhaps useful way to kind of think about it is like every individual facet of interaction that we do via agents online is liable to change. You know, where does your agent do its compute? Where can it actually access all of the data that it has access to? Can it do OAuth and actually connect to your Microsoft systems or Google systems or whatever to kind of do it? Can it touch your CRM? Can it touch the wider internet? Can it go sort of pay for something at LexisNexis and pull it? Whatever. I mean, all of these are weird ways that we have siloed the world, and the agents need to learn to navigate that kind of a siloed world. Some of it might just be that, like, look, we have to teach the agents to actually surf the web like a human, because sometimes it is just easier for the agent to do that because nobody's going to give you the right kind of APIs or right kind of CLI access for you to be able to go do that. So there is a set of things that just needs to be built, which is pretty much the entire SaaS stack bottom up that needs to become somewhat agent friendly. Some of it is easy. Some of it is less easy. Like Stripe has started doing it for shopping, and it does it for a bunch of other things where you can do it as well. It allows the agent to autonomously spin up, you know, whatever, like a container, install whatever it wants on it, run it, blah, blah, blah. There's a set of things that they're kind of trying to do. I see no reason why some version of that would not be successful in 5 years. Like, but in the sense of like successful, widely deployed, people using it regularly, etc. Like, is every single one of my ephemeral queries going to result in a large infrastructure stack somewhere kind of spinning up? Possible, because it does that to some extent today. If I do a freemium version of a SaaS application, that's how it's happening, right? So like the same principle could happen somewhere in the middle. Now, in order to get to that future, you would have to get to like several stage gates. Yes, you need to rebuild all of these. The agents themselves need to get better at like handing off from one agent to the other rather than one guy saying, I will just do everything. Because you need to be able to talk to the Stripe agent and negotiate something and come back and do the thing on your own and then go on and do it. It's the same thing for Vercel, whatever. Like, I'm just using coding examples, but it could be the same thing. Like if you want to do trip planning, or, you know, the classic example that everybody uses, you want it to be able to go off and find a bunch of places, check, come back, realize, negotiate with somebody on like WhatsApp, and then be able to move on to email for someone else. Like there's a weird form of coordination, self-coordination and coordination with other agents that it needs to be able to do. I absolutely
hand off to lower cost agent to like process some text or whatever and generate some kind of
there will be multiple agents that are doing always on kind of scans. Some are doing a return scan. Some are the smartest ones might be doing check-ins once in a while. You can imagine this entire ecosystem working together to get you the outcome that you actually want at the ultimate end of the day. Is that gonna, like, what is the new thing that will emerge from it? Unclear. Like I think if we knew it, in some ways, it wouldn't be that new anymore. You know, like I sometimes think about those old movies where they thought about surfing the internet as like kind of flying through sort of large cabinets put in some places. And like, they weren't right.
It's the Linux system.
Yeah, like, I mean. Yeah,
the classic line from Jurassic Park.
But like, that's what I'm saying. It's like you imagine these things and you're like, that's not how things turned out, right?
Right.
Instead, we have the ability to have supercomputers in our pockets and we can post memes from it all day, which people do. So it's like things evolve super weirdly. So I'm bearish on the ability to accurately forecast, but bullish on the ability to kind of say like some things will definitely happen.
Well, you've talked a little bit about an agentic user as being something like a player of StarCraft Brood War or some kind of strategy game. You know, you're multitasking, you're juggling context of like you're building your base or your infrastructure, right, dealing with some adversarial issue over here, verifying that like the the agent or the SCV that you've told to do this has actually done it in a satisfactory manner. I think this is quite interesting to think about. But does the it seems like we're a ways off the UI or even the not just the UI but like the very kind of nature of like the interaction itself being something like actually facilitating that, right? Like it still very much seems based on.
I mean, we are still in the very early innings of this. I feel like people have started to build this in some ways by being able to spin up a bunch of agents, and sometimes they bump into each other and sometimes not so much. But we are very much in the early stages of this innings. I don't think there are people who kind of say like they run whatever 10 agents at the same time on the same repo or whatever. I haven't met that many who are kind of successfully doing it for any significant thing or period of time. Because like, how do you know what you want to do?
The mental like capacity you need to manage
it's,
that.
It's a hard thing to do, right? Like, I mean, yeah. In some ways we are like the transition from like, you know, coder as an IC to coder as a manager to coder as an engineering, like, you know, lead or the CTO is a task that many people are being forced upon. But as you kind of go up, you realize the sheer importance of coordinating so many other things before you are able to just like do your damn job.
Mm.
I think like in some ways we are playing a very shitty form of StarCraft at this point. Like,
yeah.
You know, it just happens to be that your interaction happens via like Slack and WhatsApp and email, as opposed to sort of all being in some interface. Do I expect everything to be in a beautiful interface eventually? I mean, I don't know. This is one that I like to imagine. I like it being a North Star that we kind of guide towards. In some sense, I can also imagine that like the world remains pretty heterogeneous in some ways. And the job is still very much of a StarCraft player in some sense, but like your ability to do that is not sort of as easy as playing the game, because the game, the cool thing about games is that like the entire complexity is subsumed into one screen,
right?
Like the game never says like at this point you need to go read a book and come back, or like go talk to five people and come back, right? Like it's just everything you need to know is in that screen, like, which is an incredible amount of information compression into one screen that I feel like real life is just never going to get to. But I like it as a goal.
But it's a, I guess thinking outside the UI, but extending this the StarCraft analogy for a little bit, I think that the game Brood War was what 98, took off in Korea. This is going somewhere, by the way, for non StarCraft nerds. but it absolutely blew up in Korea, and I think some of the first like televised matches in that were around about 2001. Players in these kind of like futuristic things while they were playing, but then even as recently as like 2005, 2008, you know, this game was 10 years old, and if you compare the like the very best players in the world then to you know in 2008 to a you know mid-rank ladder player today, the mid-rank player today is so much better than the one, you know, even after 10 years, right? And so we were praising humanity before about being adaptable and thinking about, you know, not getting too attracted to these basins. And it's obviously like extraordinary evolutionary pressure for people to get better because their livelihoods depend on it and a lot of status. And yet it took, let's say, 15 years before something approaching like modern gameplay really emerged. And I can imagine something similar happening with agents, but you know, given what we've talked about, the massively more complexity. So even if capabilities pause today, you could still imagine it might take 20, 30 years for even an individual, let alone systems of people and bureaucracies. But even if for an individual, you know, at age 20, just getting into agentic engineering to really begin to like adapt to the tools and adapt their thinking, their ways of working, the sorts of things that they're working on, the things that we think are important to like focus on now are actually trivial irrelevancies of, you know, some little marine micro or whatever, and that the real important base has to be, you know, building your infrastructure properly. Who knows? We can only really begin to grasp at what might be important.
I think we get to that point by doing it, and you're like we won't know exactly what that looks like. There are already people who are entirely AI native or agent native starting to come into the workforce, and their way of approaching problems are quite alien to people who kind of did things before. Like, that's not going to stop at any point soon, right? Like, the more you use it, the more you are sort of adept at using it. And even things like identifying when the model's going wrong, or like asking it to do different things, or asking it to do 100 things, then choosing 2 of them from them as the right way to do it. Like, there is a variety of ways in which people use these kinds of models that are just not easily understandable to most people that like are not playing with it every day. And yeah, I expect an incredible change in how this is likely to happen in the real world.
Yeah, and it's also very relatively little cross-pollination of those ideas, particularly outside of SF, right? Like, somebody in Wellington,
I don't know, man.
Singapore is doing something, and
I feel like
no meta's, you know, really emerging.
SF is definitely a bubble, but I do feel, I mean, I keep going back to this, that, you know, Anthropic's at whatever, 50 billion, 45 billion ARR or something. Every large company basically says they're using it or playing around with it in some way, shape, or form. Most of the pieces of documents that I see created around the world are like somewhat AI written. Pangram is basically putting everything as AI. ChatGPT has like 1 billion weekly active users or something. Like, I feel like we are not in the early innings anymore. Like, people might not know how to use it well, but people do know it exists. And like, they're kind of maybe touching it or playing with it or like slightly scared or whatever. Like, I mean, there's a variety of ways in which they are, but I think we have passed the Rubicon in some ways.
I'd no disagreement there. I guess I was only just speculating that the sort of the meta that we might see emerge with, let's say, 5 years time,
yes,
where you know, prompt the models in this way when you're doing this kind of task, and you learn, you know, set these kinds of parameters over here, these kinds of things, which will become standard, I imagine, or may not, but we'll see.
I mean, I feel like
still incredibly distributed across the organization, across the world, as individuals kind of figure out what works for them. And there's not necessarily led a lot of cross-pollination.
Yeah, I think people need to figure that out for themselves in some ways. Like, we went through a phase of like prompting being super important. Then we went to a phase of like, maybe it's not that important. And now we are in the phase of like, it is really important insofar as you're able to explicitly articulate what is it that you actually want, which is like the hardest thing in the world, right? I mean, it's like, so in some ways, yes, true. But like, is that sufficient? Unclear. So I feel like we have kind of gone around in a roundabout fashion to like getting to a really hard problem. And like, I think that exists for everywhere. It's not like if you're a lawyer in, you know, New Zealand, and like you fundamentally need to prompt it sort of the same as the lawyer in San Francisco, and you just kind of learn from them same prompts or whatever. No, like, you kind of need to imbue it a little bit with like your experience and expertise and types of questions you could ask, etc.
Playing this different word language games, almost, in a way.
Maybe it's a different language game. Maybe it's like your clients are subtly different. Maybe the things that you're used to are subtly different. Maybe, I don't know. There might be like a dozen things, none of which I know of, that would change the fact, would mean the fact that like, if you're a lawyer in New Zealand, like in Wellington, you might need to ask certain things differently than if you're a lawyer in like, you know, San Francisco. Which maybe not. Maybe some of it is like very simple and straightforward, and the model just kind of, boom, gets it. You just say, I'm in New Zealand, and everything else it kind of assumes. That's also possible. But also, like, 5 years from now, when new people are setting up their practices in both of these places, how much of their profession is going to resemble what a lawyer did like 2 years ago? I don't know. Very little, I hope. But because a lot of it is rote work that should not exist, right? So,
yeah. We talked little last year with Anish Tondwalker about the idea that where junior staff members cut their teeth is in the sort of rote work that's being automated away, or that's no longer necessary. Go look up this statute or this case study or whatever it is.
Right.
And then that gives them the exposure to an organization and the sort of implicit rules of you know, advice that you might give to a client about, okay, well, here's what the law says, here's what, you know, my risk assessment is, which is where a lot of the value really sits. And they pick that up through just years of being in the meetings and having read through the case studies themselves and that kind of thing. And there's not, it's not yet clear how that looks, you know, in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, as you get this sort of generational change. Anish was very optimistic about it. Well, you know, you just have these decentralized things. People get really to the meat of the issue quicker. They actually are better, end up better lawyers than they were.
I mean, I believe they will be better lawyers as well. I just think that, like, what a better lawyer means will change quite dramatically. Right. You know, like, you know, the TV show Suits had the dude who could actually remember everything that he read. I don't know, something like that. Is that important to be a great lawyer? Maybe
common
then.
Trope like, for like now? Medical dramas and detective dramas and so on.
Is that really the limiting constraint today? I don't think so. I mean, we went through like a property legal thing in the UK recently, and I feel like the biggest benefit that the lawyer brought, like, he did some of this, and most of this was useless because, like, we could get the exact same or better information from GPT, and we did, and we kind of would send it to him. And the biggest benefit he would provide was different, to say something to the order of, like, yeah, you know, those four are the right options, or these are the things that we can do, but, like, this has a higher chance of working in my experience, or, like, based on X, Y, and Z, here, we have seen this work more than this. Like, those are things that you need a large amount of real world information before you can say, right? And like GPT's legal analysis is great and it'll probably get better, but this practical knowledge is not really embedded into GPT as much. And I mean, this is for
efficient market hypothesis kind of thing again, right?
Like, correct. There is some level of localized knowledge that doesn't exist in the model, that if you are a professional in the field and kind of doing it a lot more, you will be able to get better at. So as long as the profession exists, they would be able to do different things than what they do today. Because I don't need you to like write a 4-paragraph email outlining the 6 options. Like, that's done. We don't need that anymore. So like, don't spend 2 hours doing that. But like, do you want to do more calls explaining some of these things and where they're coming from, you're coming from, and how this actually evolves? Yeah, that's probably more useful now than before. So it's just a change in, like, there's no information arbitrage anymore.
It's probably as important as it ever has been, but we're able to, maybe this
is a local knowledge arbitrage.
We're able to kind of move up the stack a little bit more and towards, correct, the higher value kind of outputs, right?
I mean, every lawyer is now a senior lawyer.
Right.
Right. Like, that's the way I would put it. Like, they now have to focus on the exceptions and client service and what happened before and giving better advice and not just being proficient in the act of like being able to dig up case studies.
How does someone get trained into that space, though? Like, a lawyer, I mean, like a software engineer, for example, you might go, oh, well, I'm just going to publish my own stuff, and if people like, and then I can build up a portfolio, yeah, that maybe gets me hired. But if you're talking about every lawyer being a senior lawyer or every engineer being a senior engineer, how does someone in that space get their first, like, gig and get runs on the board?
I mean, the first gig gets more complex, right? The first gig itself gets more complicated. That's all. Like, I mean, it's not like, you know, just because the current first year associate's task can be done by GPT and everybody needs to act like third year associates doesn't mean that you only hire third year associates, because it just means that like the first year associates you hire next year have to be as good as like third year associates. So like, if you assume whatever a fallow period kind of goes away, that's true of everything. Investment banking analysts that are hired today are probably better than vice presidents that existed in the 90s. Because like, they just know more, do more. Like, this is true.
You still need some kind of credibility signaling, like an actual genuine principal or somebody that has a reputation.
Over a period of time. But it's the same thing, right? It's the same profession in some ways. It's just that like, the entire stack is getting upskilled. That's all. Yeah. So like, it's not like the profession is going away in some sense. It's just that like, you're just getting upskilled across the board. Like, I'll give you one stat. Like, you know, when I was at McKinsey, like the day one answer that we would provide to some of the clients, like with the pre-analysis and whatever, would be equivalent to like an entire study that was done in like the 90s. So what happened to all the people who did the studies? Like, they went up, but like the bar goes up, but your ability to deliver also goes up. And that kind of continues going up the trajectory so that everybody can just do a little bit more. Will all of it be directly useful? Hell no, because it's consulting or law or whatever. It's a service game. But at the same time, the fact that it can be done, you know, it doesn't mean that suddenly we needed less consultancy. We needed more. It means we need more bankers and more lawyers.
So does this all this show up in the productivity statistics within the next few years, do you think? Or do the gains accrue to sort of individuals working less? Do we get back to pre-1970 productivity growth, or?
I mean, the argument is that we are already starting to see some of that productivity growth coming in. In digital sector, I suspect, yes, we will start to see productivity growth if we have not already started to see. In the physical world, it's a little bit more complicated because the reasons that hold productivity growth back are not as simple as like people are just not working or being coordinated properly enough. But I am hopeful that we'll be able to see more of that there as well. And this is without assuming robots, I should say. Once you assume robots, there's a little bit more work that you can probably do. I think it's actually harder than you would give it, harder problem than we should give it credit for. Actually, let me step back. The last 50 years of technological innovation to a large extent has made us really good at like moving information back and forth from all corners to all other corners. What was lacking is like making use of that information to do something. Like you just have to like you suddenly you have 10x the amount of information coming at you, but like you need to do something with it. So like there are 17 new different BI trends that came and went, but it doesn't really mean that your decision making improved dramatically in any meaningful sense across the board, or at least like contentious conversation, but like it hasn't increased that well. Now we have this, the new trend is we have far better processing capability for the information threads that are coming down our way, which means hypothetically we are able to kind of use the information coming and make better decisions, or at the very least make decisions faster. That
So
should have
rather
an
than
effect.
just swimming in like
Data.
information, instead we make it legible, make it at least theoretically actionable,
Correct.
and then there's I guess human agency that needs to sit atop that.
Then you've got to take some action on the basis of that, but at least you're not swimming through, 3,500 dashboards before you kind of go off and do something. Presumably that has some kind of an impact. So digital realm, productivity gain, absolutely. Physical, I suspect we will start to see some just purely because of the fact that we are able to do some of the things better now than we used to be able to do before. But physical world is also like held back by all sorts of random stuff, like, from regulations to consumer interest to, I don't know, tariffs, I don't know, all sorts of different things that
Logistics,
make it harder. Yeah, exactly. So
Straits of
the life is a
Hormuz.
little correct. So these things are really difficult to kind of compress down into one thing and say whether it works or not.
Right. Great. So we're coming to the end of our time here. Is there anything else we haven't talked about that you wanted to cover off?
I think we actually did a nice tour through quite a few different things. It was
Me too.
wonderful.
I've really enjoyed the chat. Look, thanks so much, Rohit Krishnan, for chatting with me. Go check out Strange Loop Canon. There'll be a link in the video description, I'm sure, and on Substack. His work's absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure you've hinted at some some experimental work that you've yet to publish. So check that out.
I have several coming out over the next like 5 6 weeks that I've queued up. There's a bunch of cool stuff that's, I think, at least cool to me, that is definitely coming up that explores much of the conversation that we had a lot more in detail. I feel like one of the, weirdly enough, when I started doing this at some point last year, I felt like there is some new world here where you can actually do social science experiments on agents, social science economics experiments on agents. There's no word for this new field that exists, and it is enormously fun. It teaches you a huge amount, and it's kind of in its genesis. So it's fun to play around, and that's why I have like more ideas than even I know what to do with, or even my agents can handle at some point. It's fun.
And it's
Thank you for having me.
only going to become more important as these
I hope.
things diffuse through the organ
I
through
believe
the
so.
economy.
I believe
Look,
so.
thanks again. A real pleasure speaking with you.
My pleasure, Adam. This was lovely.